Kathy has said that she will take questions. She would prefer to take questions at the end of the session, please. And if you could step up to the microphone when you want to ask a question, because this is being recorded. Okay, once again, welcome to session 215, a new paradigm for depression in postpartum mothers. My name is Rosemary Gordon, and I'm on the La Leche League International Board of Directors, and it is my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Kathleen Kendall Tackett. Kathy is a health psychologist, an international board certified lactation consultant, and research associate professor of psychology, specializing in women's health at the Family Research Lab at the University of New Hampshire. She is a fellow of the American Psychological Association in both divisions of health psychology and trauma psychology. Dr. Kendall Tackett is a La Leche League leader, chair of the New Hampshire Breastfeeding Task Force, and area coordinator of leaders for La Leche League of Maine and New Hampshire. That's the most important bit. Dr. Kendall Tackett, because she's just Kathy to me. Kathy is the author of more than 150 journal articles, book chapters, and other publications, and author or editor of 15 books, including The Hidden Feelings of Motherhood, Depression in New Mothers, Breastfeeding Made Simple, co-authored with Nancy Moorbacher. It's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Kathleen Kendall Tackett.
And the party going until 11 o'clock last night, it's sometimes difficult to get up. And I wanted to thank Rosemary for that lovely introduction. I've been at a few conferences where I've had some kind of interesting introductions. One, when I was at a conference last year, and I won't tell you what. Okay, well, I didn't get introduced that way at this conference, obviously. I want to start out by saying I put little CD-ROMs, or Rosemary and I passed out some lovely little CD-ROMs on your desk, and I don't have my computer up here. This is the conference computer. But what I want to tell you about what is on here is my breastfeeding task force in New Hampshire made postpartum depression their issue this year. And we developed a curriculum for healthcare providers on postpartum depression that is breastfeeding friendly. And the reason that we did is because I was out in the field, and, you know, I speak a lot. You know, I would say probably the majority of conferences I speak at are breastfeeding and lactation conferences. I do a lot of nursing ed. But I've been at some postpartum depression conferences recently where the specific issue that's been addressed. And that's never been a group that's been particularly breastfeeding friendly. I've actually been in that longer than I've been in the breastfeeding field. It's gotten a little bit better, but I've been hearing some fairly alarming things. And, you know, for example, the attitude at the conference I was just at recently was kind of like, well, if mothers must breastfeed. And some of the recommendations have been things like avoiding nighttime breastfeeding. You know, I'm not sure exactly how that's going to work, but... but one of the more disturbing things is I've been getting some emails from people who've been to specific trainings and stuff and been told that breastfeeding is a risk factor for depression. Yeah. So, you know, I'm seeing this coming because what is happening in the United States is we're starting to see mandatory legislation that will be screening for postpartum depression. It's the state of New Jersey has passed one. There's one in the works right now at the federal level, and a lot of states are coming on board. Now, I actually think that's a good thing. I think, you know, the more we know about postpartum depression, I think the better. However, if the breastfeeding community is not prepared for this, I think some policies could be put in place that will be actually quite harmful. One of the things I heard at this conference I was just at is somebody was very enthusiastically telling me that an OB in their hospital was routinely sending mothers home who were at risk for depression. So they weren't even depressed yet, but sending them home with estriol patches. And, you know, that's a metabolite of estrogen, and that completely torpedoes breastfeeding. You know, and if that doesn't work for a couple of weeks, then they go on antidepressant medications. And, you know, I even said, you know, wow, I said, you know, it's very great that, you know, obstetrician is thinking ahead and trying to be proactive with moms. I said, but I am a little concerned about the impact that has on milk supply and breastfeeding. And you could see the curtain come down. So I want us to try to work together constructively. I think that that's an appropriate thing. Another conference I was just at, they came... there was a group that was gathering for the Los Angeles County, which is, you know, a large county with several million people, gathering a whole task force together on maternal mental health. The breastfeeding community was deliberately excluded. Yeah, and the reason was that the person organizing this had had a bad experience, you know, sort of with a breastfeeding advocate when she was a new mother. So I want us all to be up to speed on this. So this curriculum that we've developed is copyright free. You can, and it's in PDF format. You can, you know, exchange it. You can, you know, send it around to people, share it with people. We also have three handouts for mothers on here, one on how different sort of cross cultures help support new mothers in the postpartum period, and two others on omega-3s and depression. These also are copyright free. For those listening on the tape, I can tell you where to get this curriculum. It's at www.nhbreastfeedingtaskforce.org. Okay, so... speaking of websites, hang on, here we go. I just want to mention that we have two. BreastfeedingMadeSimple.com is the site that Nancy and I put up for, it's the companion website for Breastfeeding Made Simple. The reason I mention it in this talk is because I have a whole page for mothers who are depressed. And so there's a lot of resources. And the more resources, you know, every time I see resources, I add them. Granite Scientific, I actually just redid. This is my technical site, and there are literally hundreds of articles on there. It actually took me a while to sort of assemble them all. It's called, you know, I've had people say, well, why is it Granite Scientific? What does this have to do with countertops? And it's like, well, nothing. I live in the, you know, New Hampshire is the Granite State, so I tried to think of something kind of generic. A lot of the stuff we're going to talk about today in terms of trauma, in terms of childhood maltreatment, and in terms of depression, some of the stuff about omega-3s and depression, I've got tons of articles up there. So what I want to do is sort of facilitate this stuff getting out and broadly used in the field. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about... what I see is kind of an amazing shift that's taken place in how we talk about depression. Now, depression is something I've been looking at since 1990. As a brand new postdoctoral fellow at the University of New Hampshire and also a brand new mother. I had my first son when I was 1 month. I just finished my dissertation defense, and 1 month later I became a mother. And one of the things it's not a good way to do it. One of the things I discovered in that process is that a PhD in developmental psychology does not help you at all when you are a mother. But I remember actually telling my advisor that we had decided to let Ken sleep with us. I mean, he was still a newborn. And my advisor says, oh, he says, I can't believe it. He says, you know, we, you know, give you this fantastic education, you know, you got this nice degree. And she says, then you become a mother and it just sucks all the learning right out of your head. You know, it's... So this is something actually, you know, I've been interested in for a long time. You know, Glenda Kaufman Kanner and I wrote our first book on this back in 1992. So I've been in this literature for a long, long time. And there's been kind of a very interesting shift, and it kind of comes from several different angles. And when I started kind of putting this together was last summer. I was preparing to speak at the International Lactation Consultant Association conference. And at the same time, I had been invited to participate in a research symposium on violence against women at the University of Kentucky. And that summit was, you know, just researchers. We all just talked to each other. And we were all interested in the physical health consequences of violence against women. And that's an area that, you know, I've been studying for a long, long time. It's of great interest to me. Well, one of the papers that I was doing in that session was looking at metabolic syndrome, which is the precursor syndrome to type 2 diabetes, and heart disease in women who have experienced violence. And so while I was working on that literature, I was also preparing for the ILCA talk. And those two wouldn't sound like they would necessarily have a lot of overlap. But what happened is this wonderful kind of synergy that you get sometimes. And I started seeing that there was, in fact, a considerable amount of overlap between those. And so it kind of took what we knew, particularly about postpartum depression, and instead of looking at it this way, it's like looking at it like this. So we're still looking at the same risk factors, but it's just this kind of shift in how we sort of organize it. So let me show you kind of what is the old paradigm. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with this paradigm. I think it's actually very helpful. And I'm going to do sort of a pictorial representation of it. Now, this actually, what I'm going to be showing you today, is based on a paper I did in the International Breastfeeding Journal. And that is actually available on their website. And that is also an open access, you know, you can download it for free article. But this is kind of looking at sort of the things that we know that are the traditional risk factors for depression. Okay, so this is a representation here of stress. Stress is a big one. I actually first started looking at that when I was doing a paper called The Physiological Correlates of Childhood Abuse, and was noticing, spending a lot of time looking at some of the neuropsychiatric factors that follow some of the sequelae that we see, like depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. One of the things I noticed, and really it was quite striking, was that stress and depression physiologically were very, very similar to each other. And so, you know, that became something that I started including in my own work, and in fact, other research has come along that has confirmed that. Okay, we're also talking about fatigue and sleep deprivation, and this is, you know, of course, huge. You know, and I think it's unfortunate because I don't think we have really studied this very well in terms of postpartum mothers because it's so ubiquitous. We think, okay, well, all mothers are sleep deprived. But there are different types of sleep deprivation and there are different types of issue. And for women who have a trauma history, women who have experienced any kind of psychological trauma have terrible sleep. And it's just something that is a field in trauma we are actually starting to address. And in fact, I have a little article I actually put up on Breastfeeding Made Simple looking specifically at sleep and trauma survivors. You know, so even for women who haven't, having that sort of fractured sleep, particularly of certain kinds, and we'll talk about what those are, really actually does increase the risk for depression. You know, unfortunately, I think sometimes the solution that people offer is just, you know, cut out sort of nighttime breastfeeding, which, as I mentioned, I don't think is a great solution. You know, so that's, I think, when we want to start talking about co-sleeping, I think that gives us more of a background to be able to do that. Okay, also pain. This is another area that I'm actually very interested in. Pain is an extremely potent trigger to depression. And again, you know, sort of some of my background in this was looking at the literature in, you know, the family violence field and noting that a lot of chronic pain syndromes tended to co-occur with trauma. But what you also see from a physiological standpoint is that chronic pain looks an awful lot like depression. And they're what we would call in the research field highly comorbid. You know, so think about it in terms of Venn diagrams. The circles overlap quite a bit. Most chronic pain patients also experience depression. And it's interesting, too, because one of the ways you treat chronic pain is with antidepressants. And so it suggests that there's a tremendous overlap. I don't think we've necessarily looked at this in terms of postpartum women, but the few studies that we've seen, I think, suggest that it is, in fact, a pretty serious problem. Now, this is a relative newcomer here. This is inflammation. And what we're looking at in terms of inflammation is the increase in blood of substances known as pro-inflammatory cytokines. And so these are actually sort of systemic. Now, people say, well, is that like inflammation, like if you, you know, get a cut on your foot and it becomes red? It is the same process, but where it actually gets to be a problem is when it becomes systemic. And in fact, we'll talk about a little bit about how things like depression and hostility and other things actually move those pro-inflammatory cytokines away from where they should be and have them running around systemically. Okay, but this actually first popped up on the sort of charts about 7 years ago. There's a researcher in the Netherlands, he used to be at Antwerp, by the name of Michael Myers. And Michael Myers is just brilliant. I mean, his work is just so encompassing. And he also, you know, it's funny because you don't meet too many people who study both perinatal health and, you know, trauma and violence against women. But he is actually one of the ones who does. And he actually first noted that inflammation levels were high in women who had postpartum depression and anxiety, higher than sort of the normal levels. Okay, psychological trauma, of course, you know, huge, you know, again, another very highly comorbid symptom. Psychological trauma is very common. Now, not everybody develops post-traumatic stress disorder, but the percentage of women who have experienced one or more traumatic events in their life is, I think, you know, running around 50%, according to the National Center on PTSD. Okay, and also if you have a history of a previous affective disorder, okay, so that's what that is. So if you have prior episodes of depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, or other mood disorders, you become much more vulnerable to subsequent episodes of depression. And again, it's that sort of stress-depression connection that you become more primed to actually become depressed. Now, what I always tell mothers, though, is that is not inevitable. You know, just because you have a risk factor does not mean you will succumb to it. And in fact, oftentimes it's the mothers who know they're vulnerable, who make sure that they set into place good support for themselves, are the ones that in fact overcome it. Okay, so all of these things we've talked about in terms of being individual risk factors for depression. Okay, so let's look at how this has kind of shifted. Okay, so we have the ones we just talked about. We have stress, we have pain, sleep deprivation, trauma, history of affective disorders. But here is how it's changed. What we have discovered is that the way that the body translates all these different kinds of experiences is to increase inflammation. And it was interesting the way we kind of discovered this. Again, you know, it's one of the things that happens in research is a lot of times it's not a straight path. Gee, I think let's look at this over here and we go off and study it. There's a process in research called triangulation. And it's kind of like you have people who are over here studying this topic and over here studying this topic and over here studying this completely different topic, and yet they all end up back at the same place. And so that's when you start kind of understanding all these different processes and how they work. Okay, so what they discovered, this is actually the first kind of major sort of area of research that looked at this, is that women who were taking care of husbands with Alzheimer's disease were dying at pretty high rates, higher than they would expect. Okay, and it was that what they call caregiver stress that was, in fact, increasing their risk of disease. And it was several different types. It was things like cancer, it was heart disease, it was diabetes. And what they discovered, the mechanism for that, was this increase in systemic inflammation. And the thing that was difficult about that is even after the women were no longer caring for their spouses, after their spouses had passed away, that those inflammation levels were remaining high. You know, and again, I think there's a lot of ways we can sort of modify that now that we know that. But when Christopher Reeve's wife passed away of cancer, it was the first thing I thought of. Because, you know, even though you know that she had a lot of, you know, resources to help, I mean, having a husband who went from being, you know, sort of vital and athletic to becoming a quadriplegic, I think was probably just a devastating experience. And unfortunately, I think it did increase her risk for disease. So what I'm going to be talking about today is from a field by the name of psychoneuroimmunology, okay, or PNI for short. Now, I write this out because if you haven't heard this term before, it's like, what? What did you just say? Okay, so it's psychoneuroimmunology. And basically what PNI research looks at is that sort of interface between what's going on in the brain and what goes on in the immune system. And, you know, it's funny because PNI researchers, that's a branch of within health psychology. PNI researchers tend to be sort of the techno geeks of, you know, psychological and social science research. It is tend to be very technical, and unfortunately, a lot of this research is not making it out into the sort of broader healthcare community. Because unless you read journals like Brain Behavior and Immunity, Psychoneuroimmunology, Psychosomatic Medicine, those are the big PNI journals, and they are not somehow getting out into the broader healthcare field. But I think you'll see that this stuff is actually highly relevant to our work with new mothers. Okay, so what we have discovered really is that all those other risk factors tie back to inflammation. And so this inflammation effect actually increases the risk of depression. But what we have, you know, unfortunately discovered is that it's what we call a bidirectional relationship. That not only does inflammation increase the risk of depression, but it goes the other way around. That when you are depressed, it also increases those inflammatory markers. And so people get into a very bad cycle. You know, we've often talked about that in terms of like sleep deprivation and depression. You know, that when people are very fatigued, they're at an increased risk for becoming depressed. But being depressed makes them more tired. You know, so you get into this bad cycle. And I've had people say, well, you know, which one of these do you think comes first? You know, from a physiological standpoint, it really probably doesn't matter. I suspect probably in most cases this comes first. And I'll talk to you a little bit about the lines of research and why we know that. Okay, but depression can also create these mental states. I have a friend, Jim Flatt, and I are editing a book for American Psych Association looking specifically at this effect and in terms of chronic disease. And so we're looking at that kind of, you know, sort of unholy trinity of negative mental states, inflammation, and chronic disease. And we're actually doing a presentation in San Francisco at the American Psych Association next month and looking specifically at things like, you know, sort of this trauma, depression, hostility, and how that impacts, you know, what's going on in your body. And the effects are just unbelievably potent. Okay, so in terms of what we talk about in terms of postpartum mothers, one of the things that we know is that a lot of the common experiences of new mothers do increase inflammation. Okay, now, does that mean everybody's going to get depressed? No, I think you know that it doesn't. But these are all things we need to be kind of watching, because so often our moms think they got to, especially here in the U.S., they feel like they've got to just tough it out, you know, and that they've got to, you know, sort of get in there and do things all by themselves. But the I think what this is going to show is that, you know, that is not necessarily a good idea. Okay, so stress we've already talked about. Stress definitely, and any type of stress, physical or psychological. And for many mothers, it's the combination of both that tends to be pretty potent. Pain also increases that experience. Sleep disturbance. Anytime you are, you know, sleep deprived, and as a matter of fact, we probably have a living laboratory of that at this conference, right? But when you are sleep deprived, it only takes a couple of days before things like your insulin resistance goes up. Okay, so if you've got people who have been chronically sleep deprived, you know, we know that they're at higher risk for disease. Okay, now that's not to say, oh gosh, that's one more thing to keep you awake at night. Oh no, I'm increasing my risk of disease. But do know that, yeah. But do know that this is a process. Okay, and so, you know, it is physiologically very stressful. You know, one of the things sometimes when I talk to moms, you know, they'll sit there and they're so tired and they're so sleep deprived. And they'll say, God, I don't understand why I'm just not doing this better. You know, and why is this bothering me so much? And I point out to them that sleep deprivation is actually used as a means of torture. Right? You know, why are we surprised that moms feel bad about that? You know, and I think it's because of these sort of physiological mechanisms. Okay, also psychological trauma. And again, this is an area, you know, I've had a long-standing interest in. Okay, so let's first talk a little bit about stress. I want to kind of give you an idea why stress would make a difference. Okay, now some of us are old enough here, or some of us, you know, growing up in the U.S., we remember a certain campaign that the Ad Council did about this is your brain on drugs. You know, remember when he cracked the egg into the frying pan? Okay, so what we're going to do is this is your brain on stress. And so here's your little frying pan. Yeah. Okay, so what we are looking at is really a tripart response. You know, and the first two parts of this we've actually known for a long time. And I said it's the next part, it's that sort of immune piece that is relatively new. And again, these all work together. That's why we have these sort of, you know, arrows here. You know, to show that these all interact with each other. This is a very highly complex and really, in my view, miraculous system that really tries to sort of check and balance and keep things kind of on a level of sort of homeostasis. Okay, so the first thing we talk about are the catecholamines. Now, I'm going to tell you what those are in just a minute, okay? But this is basically your fight or flight response. Okay, these are your first responders. That when you perceive threat, okay, and that threat can be physical threat or it can be psychological threat, the catecholamines are the first to respond. Okay, so it's norepinephrine, epinephrine, and dopamine. I've got a slide for that next. But it's that sort of, you know, adrenaline boost to kind of get you out of that situation. Okay, and then we hear more and more about the HPA axis. Okay, and that stands for hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. That's actually also on a slide, so you don't need to worry about that. Oh, and speaking of slides, if you're listening to the tape or if you didn't get the syllabus, I actually put the slides for this up on Breastfeeding Made Simple. So it's on the navigation bar under 2007 slides. Okay, pro-inflammatory cytokines. And that's the thing that's kind of new, is that we are talking about how the immune system also responds. Now, if you think about that from a survival standpoint, that makes a lot of sense. Because, you know, if you are anticipating that you're going to be in some life-threatening situation, doesn't it make sense that your immune system jumps up and is ready to respond? Okay, and that's actually exactly what's happening, that these are all survival mechanisms. But the problem is, and the thing that we encounter that I think increases our risk of disease, is instead of being an acute response, oftentimes when you have things like, you know, severe stress or psychological trauma or depression, that these things actually become sort of chronic, and then that's when they tend to create a lot of physiological difficulties. Okay, so let's talk about the catecholamines. Okay, as I mentioned, they're norepinephrine, epinephrine, and dopamine. Epinephrine is another name for adrenaline, and this is noradrenaline. These are three neurotransmitters, and again, as I mentioned, these are kind of the first responders. So as soon as you perceive a threat, these things come, and these things come instantly. Okay, the HPA axis. The HPA axis is a little more slowly responding, you know, often within 20 minutes or so of perceiving a threat. So it's not quite as quick as the fight or flight response. Okay, but it's three parts. So the first is the hypothalamus, which is a structure in the brain. Okay, and it releases a substance called CRH, or depending on the author, sometimes they call it CRF. Okay, and it is usually abbreviated like that. I can tell you that that stands for corticotropin releasing factor. Now, aren't you glad you know that? You can share that tonight at a party. Okay, that actually causes sort of a cascade. So then the next thing that responds is another brain structure called the pituitary, which I'm sure most of you are very familiar with, especially if you have teenagers. I have two teenage boys. Yeah, we're right in the middle of pituitary. That actually releases a substance called ACTH. Okay, and again, it is usually listed that way in the literature. That's adrenocorticotropin hormone. And finally, the adrenal cortex. So the cortex of the adrenal gland releases a substance that's much more familiar, and that is cortisol. And I always say, you know, people tend to be familiar with cortisol because they had that commercial they keep showing on infomercials here where it blocks cortisol and it's going to make you lose weight. And then they show you what the cortisol weight gain pattern is that looks distressingly familiar. The cortisol is a stress hormone, and it's the one we tend to talk about as being elevated. And like what Nils was talking about yesterday and today, is that cortisol, you know, is a stress hormone that we don't necessarily want to see chronically elevated. We know that it creates a lot of mischief in the body. It does a lot of bad things, like, for example, suppressing lymphocytes. And so it actually lowers things like white blood cell counts. We also know that it's very toxic to brain cells. Now, that is not to say if you have one bad experience, things are permanently marred. But do know that these are actually important effects. You know, and it's one thing you can kind of argue, too, when you've got, you know, somebody who's, say, for example, not responding to a baby, you know, who's crying in a, you know, sitting there in a little, you know, isolette, that the cortisol actually can damage brain cells. Now, the hopeful news in this is, in the child maltreatment field, this has been sort of a concerning line of research, because what people have taken away from that is, oh my gosh, there's nothing that we can do. The brain structure is damaged. Well, there's a group down at Emory. Doug Bremner is the lead researcher there, and he's done amazing. He's like one of the leaders in this field. He's actually discovered with some of the patients who have, you know, severe post-traumatic stress disorder, so really kind of on the high end of these kind of exposures and damages, that the structure that tends to really get damaged with cortisol actually can be rebuilt with antidepressant medication. Now, this is not an infomercial for antidepressant medication. What I want to just put across is that some of these things are reversible. Okay, and I think that that's kind of an important message, because I think it's really difficult sometimes to hear some of this neurobiological stuff. We do need to acknowledge that those effects are real and do exist, but they're not the end of the story. And so it is kind of important to acknowledge that. Okay, so finally, we talk about the immune system. And this is the pro-inflammatory cytokines. Now, a cytokine is a messenger molecule. And pro-inflammatory just means it increases inflammation. There are pro-inflammatory cytokines and anti-inflammatory. And again, it's this really absolutely elegant, you know, process of chemical, you know, goings on in the body that protects us. And that's what it's for. And what the pro-inflammatory cytokines do is that they protect us against infection. That seems to be one of their primary roles. But they have other roles, and I'll show you what they are in terms of pregnant and postpartum women. But pro-inflammatory cytokines, the ones that we talk about, the most, these are the ones we tend to see a lot in the studies. And again, I don't think that this is necessarily all of them, but these are the ones that we have identified as being related to some of these variables. Because again, I think this is a very complex system, and I think we're just kind of at the surface in terms of understanding how all these interactions work. But the first is known as IL-1 beta, or interleukin-1 beta. IL-6, this was actually the first one that was really kind of discovered. That's the one that they discovered in the studies with Alzheimer's patients and caregivers. Okay, and TNF-alpha, if any of you are familiar with the rheumatology literature, TNF-alpha is the one that is often implicated in things like rheumatoid arthritis. Okay, and a lot of the new biologic treatments for RA and other autoimmune diseases are TNF-alpha inhibitors. Okay, and this one, interferon gamma, this one's a little bit newer. And I'm not sure exactly how this one's going to turn out, because in the studies, at least so far, it's kind of been contradictory in terms of the findings. The first three have actually been, you know, really pretty consistent. But the last one, we're not really sure yet. But it does show up in research studies, so I wanted to mention it. Okay, so question is, how does this relate to some of these other psychological variables? And what I'd like to do now is just kind of walk you through just a little bit of some of the cardiac literature. And like I said, this is a very, very, very exciting field. Literally, stuff is coming out every week. And in fact, I would say probably the majority of the really cool stuff that I'm going to show you is within the last 2 years. And it's been really thrilling. The way actually that book I told you about that I'm editing, the way I pitched that book to the editor is I sat down with her and I pulled out issues of journals and said, look, this is the July 2006 issue of Health Psychology. Look what they found. Here's the June British Journal of Psychiatry. Look what they found. And just kind of laid it out for her. And I said, this field is absolutely exploding. I want to see if we can bring this work together. Okay, so it's been really kind of a thrilling thing. And so it's like I said, it comes from a lot of different diverse fields. So now you might wonder why we got some people up here. It's like, you know how crime shows, how they always say, well, let's round up the usual suspects. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. We're going to round up the usual suspects in depression. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about attributional style. And again, I'm just going to kind of give you a little taste of this stuff, just so you can kind of see how amazing this system is and really how much that sort of information paradigm really fits it. Okay, attributional style is basically how do people explain the world? It's kind of, to give it sort of a, more colloquial, are you an optimist or are you a pessimist? When something bad happens, do you think it's because of some characterological flaw in you, or do you think it was just one of those things that happened? Do you think it will be, hopeless and it will never get better, that it affects every area of your life? Those are all characteristics of the pessimistic attributional style. And one of the things that we know is that type of worldview increases inflammation. Okay, self-efficacy. This is in some ways, a related construct. Do you feel competent? Do you feel like you have the power within yourself to create positive changes in your life? I actually think that this is going to be a very important variable to study in terms of breastfeeding, because I'm sure probably everybody in this room has at some point worked with a mom who had a solvable breastfeeding problem but said it's hopeless and we can't do anything about it. I suspect that if you measure self-efficacy, you would find that it was low in that mom. Okay, so self-efficacy, is basically, how competent do you feel? How competent do you feel as a mother? How competent do you feel as somebody, navigating the healthcare system? All of these things make a huge difference. When they look at studies on HIV treatment regimens, now I'm probably a lot of you are familiar that when you do these sort of antiviral treatments, there's a very exacting schedule that you have to be on. This medication has to be taken at 10, and this one has to be taken at 2, and if you miss doses, it absolutely increases the viral load. It's very measurable. And yet 68% of patients miss at least some of their dosages. Okay, so it's a very important thing to find out why that is. The patients that are most likely to miss their medications or not adhere to their medication regimen are low in self-efficacy. They don't think it's going to make any difference. They don't like the side effects, but they don't talk to their doctors about it. So you can see self-efficacy is actually something that really, in many cases, actually can predict the difference between life and death. Okay, I mentioned history of depression. History of depression, of course, is a very important risk factor. If you have a history of depression, you are more likely to respond to current stressors with inflammation. Okay, again, it's this idea that the body becomes sensitized for other possible threats. The way I often describe it is it's kind of like if you have somebody who's been in combat. Okay, they could be sitting in a room like this and hear a click, and they think it's a trigger, and they're down on the floor. It's like they become hypervigilant, very, very sensitive. Well, the immune system acts the same way. And so if you have a history of things like depression or post-traumatic stress disorder, your body actually becomes primed to respond in a certain way. Okay, now crying baby, we don't have this in terms of inflammation yet, but I wanted to mention it because I think it's really interesting. This actually came from the child maltreatment field. What they discovered is that mothers and fathers who are at risk for maltreating their children, often because they had their own history of maltreatment, have a very different physiological response to the sound of a crying baby than somebody who's not at risk. Okay, big, big, big increase in stress hormones. So I suspect if we looked at this, we would also find inflammation there too. Okay, ill or premature baby, a couple of recent studies have found that this definitely increases the risk of things like acute stress disorder, which is the precursor for post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, we know that. It's funny, it's one of those things, it's like we know. We know because we see it, but we don't know in terms of, like, nobody has studied it. Well, there are a couple of recent studies that actually have specifically found that. And as we'll talk about, post-traumatic stress disorder actually does increase inflammation. You see that pretty consistently. Okay, so this, again, is from the cardiac literature, and I just thought this was absolutely fascinating. There's a whole body of research literature looking at a variable known as social capital. And social capital has to do with how connected do people feel within their communities. Okay, and it's studied by economists, and it's studied by sort of community planners. And where I actually was able to locate a lot of the studies, I never would have thought about this, but one of the researchers in it's kind of steered me toward it. The World Bank has actually a number of articles on social capital. But what they have found is looking at these very macro-level variables. So it's things like, did you vote? Do you know your neighbors' names? Okay, again, sort of not sort of the typical sort of psychological things we look at. That actually, you can go, you know, neighborhood by neighborhood, community by community, state by state, and track, you know, things like low social cohesion, low social integration, with increased heart attack, diabetes, all the things that we look at. Okay, and it is, I think, the research is actually starting to show due to this inflammatory process. There was an article that was literally, it was in May 2007, Health Psychology, that actually specifically looked at women who had high social integration. It means they had a lot of sort of people in their lives that were, you know, caring and supporting for them versus low, and did in fact find an increase in IL-6 with the women who did not have a lot of other people supportive in their life. Okay, so it's exactly what you'd expect. Like I said, for me, kind of the clue that we need to look at it is when they start talking about diabetes and heart disease. You know, what recent research over the last couple of years has indicated is that both of those diseases are due to inflammation. Okay, that's kind of the underlying thing, and that a lot of these other risk factors fit within that. But what happens is that systemic inflammation. Okay, so I mentioned low community support. You have the same thing with low partner support. If you don't have partner support, that is not only a stressor in and of itself, but you don't have that stress buffering effect. Okay, one of the things we're going to talk about, Nancy and I are going to talk about tomorrow when we do the Breastfeeding Made Simple talk, is how it's not just that mother and baby, that these are actually effects that happen throughout our lives. It explains why things like if you're in the hospital and your loved ones are with you, you heal faster, right? I mean, does that make sense? That makes perfect sense. If you don't have sort of friends you can talk to, that you actually have a higher risk of dying. David Siegel, who's a researcher at Stanford, he was one of the first ones that really demonstrated the impact of social support. And his sample was a group of women with stage 4 ovarian cancer. Okay, now, there have been a number of studies that have come since then. But what he discovered was that the women who had, they were participating in a support group. The women participating in the support group lived twice as long as the women who did not. Okay, incredible impact. And what we have kind of discovered is that what that does is it lowers those inflammation levels because it lowers stress. It's that sort of stress buffering effect. So not only is this good for babies, this is good throughout the lifespan. You know, I think we have this sort of paradigm, as Nils was talking about this morning, we have this paradigm that says we need to move toward independence, that that's the goal, that that's where we need to be. We need to train our children to do that. But what we really have learned is that we are not meant to be alone. We are meant to be in community with others. Okay, so low income is a similar thing because a lot of those macro level variables we talked about, you know, feeling dangerous in your community, not feeling like you know your neighbors, you know, feeling like people are out to sort of harm you, which in fact they may in fact be. But these are all variables that make a difference. And we know there's huge health disparities based on income. Okay, and again, looking at it, when you start seeing certain patterns of diseases, you need to think inflammation. And finally, I love this one, perceived racism. This is just amazing. You know, you find that if people perceive that somebody is discriminating against them, that it increases that stress level and increases the level of inflammation. And you know, what I like about this is it gets kind of past that, is it real racism or isn't it? From the patient's standpoint, it actually doesn't matter. It's if they perceive it, if they experience it, that's what matters. Okay, so why is this relevant to pregnant and postpartum women? One of the things that happens in the last trimester of pregnancy is that the pro-inflammatory cytokines automatically rise. Now think about, why would that be a good idea? For one thing, after birth, you're going to have a cervix that's open. You're going to have, you know, an increased risk of infection. And so it's a defense mechanism. But what I thought was actually so cool about that when I read that is one of the things we found, and I actually reviewed this in Depression in New Mothers, one of the shifts that had happened in between sort of when I did the first book in 92 and when I did the second book in 2005, is that we know that it's not postpartum that women are at the highest risk. It's the last trimester of pregnancy. And I just thought that was fascinating. And, you know, when I first read it, it's kind of like, you know, you see that depression during pregnancy is the strongest predictor of postpartum depression. And, you know, at first you think, well, yeah, duh. But one of the things that you start thinking about is, you know, that's another piece of evidence that demonstrates that it's not the estrogen and progesterone levels that really have an impact. You know, because if that were true, you wouldn't see that pattern. What you would see instead is that, you know, women's mental health would be the best in the last trimester of pregnancy because that's when those levels are highest. You know, and so when I read this, I immediately recognized the pattern and I thought, oh, that so totally explains what you see in the research. Okay, and that in fact these cytokines do remain elevated postpartum. Okay, so we know that there's a vulnerability, but think about it from a survival standpoint. Would it make sense for us to be so vulnerable without some way to buffer that? No, I don't believe it would, because I think depression is pretty serious. And so this is what we've learned, is that breastfeeding, in fact, is the thing that protects maternal mental health. And we really haven't gotten a lot of studies on this, but the growing consensus is that women who breastfeed have lower rates of postpartum depression. Now, I'll talk to you a little bit about why that is and why I think we've been kind of confused by that in a minute. We're going to come back to this. But it does lower stress. Okay, however, it's a very important distinction that women who are having breastfeeding difficulties, that increases inflammation. Okay, so we need to sort of tease that out. And actually, one of the articles, I just wrote an article for Medications and More that I should be out like next month, I think. But talking about how, you know, we, I think, can make a pretty compelling case that lactation support be part of a postpartum depression prevention team. Because if we have moms who are sort of soldiering on with, like, for example, cracked and bleeding nipples, you know, their mental health is at risk, you know, and that problem needs to be addressed. Okay, so this inflammation kind of paradigm I thought was actually very intriguing for another reason, and that was thinking about preterm birth. Okay, and so one of the things we've actually known this for a while, is that depression and post-traumatic stress disorder are both risk factors for preterm birth. Okay, and there have been a number of studies on this. I'll show you this one. This one was actually from France. It's a prospective study of almost 700 women. Okay, so these women were enrolled during pregnancy, and they just sort of were following them. These women were receiving regular prenatal care. They were considered basically low risk. You know, they were being sort of monitored all through pregnancy. But look at this. More than twice the rate of preterm birth among the depressed versus the non-depressed mothers. Yeah. And there have been a number of studies, actually, that have found that, but I wanted to at least show you that one because I thought that was cool. See, and this one's, again, in Psychosomatic Medicine. It's one of the P&I journals. Okay, now, one of the things I was kind of thinking about with this, because, you know, I used to work on a big premature baby study, you know, so it's kind of like I got pretty familiar with that literature. One of the things I was thinking about this is I said, you know, I wonder if we're going to find that this is related to inflammation, too. Because if you think about the populations, particularly in the U.S., who tend to have the highest rates of preterm birth, they're also the populations that have the highest rates of metabolic syndrome, diabetes, heart disease. Okay, right? Okay, so then I found this. What they found in this study is they specifically looked at this, and they wanted to see, you know, was in women who are immediately postpartum, was there increases in IL-6 and TNF-alpha in the stressed and depressed moms? And they did, in fact, find that. Okay, and what they noted was that, in my opinion, they put forth a very plausible mechanism by which this would increase preterm birth, because the other thing that these pro-inflammatory cytokines do is ripen the cervix, and they bring on labor. Doesn't that make sense? I was actually so thrilled when I found this study. I was like banging my hand on the copier up at Dartmouth, you know. I was like, I knew it. You know, I was expecting them to come in and tell me to leave. Okay, and also too, the stress hormone that we talked about that's related to the hypothalamus also triggers labor. Okay, so if you've got somebody who's very stressed and or depressed, and remember I told you those are very physiologically similar, that it actually can bring on labor. Okay, so let me show you this one. You'll like this one. I think that sort of inflammation explains these findings here. Now, I always thought this was kind of a cool little study. This was actually back in 2003. But I thought this was really kind of a fun study. You know, but I don't think it makes sense sort of out of context. This was actually a nice little intervention. It was a randomized clinical trial. They had 291 low-income women. It was in Kansas City. It was a WIC population, 73% African-American. Okay. Now, African Americans have the highest rates of preterm birth, and you know, I mean, I know you know all about the mortality disparities and stuff within different ethnic groups. Okay, so what they did with these moms is they assigned them to they had to eat eggs, one egg a day. That's what they needed to do. Now, I was out in Mississippi, and somebody asked me, well, could they bake with it? And I said, well, yeah, but you have to eat the whole thing, so that could be a problem. Okay, but what they did is they enriched these eggs with either the omega-3 fatty acid DHA, which we're going to come back and talk to, versus just a regular egg. So this was about 133 milligrams, and this was like 29 milligrams, give or take. And so the moms had to eat an egg every day during the last trimester of pregnancy. Very simple little intervention. The moms were willing to do it. The way they get the DHA in the eggs, this I think is really cool. They feed it to the chickens, and about 50% of it transfers into the eggs. Okay, and what it did, just this tiny little intervention, increased the gestation length 6 days. Okay, plus or minus 2. Okay, now that's published in Obstetrics and Gynecology. You know, that's a real mainline journal, and I just thought that was fascinating. And doesn't that make sense that using an anti-inflammatory omega-3 fatty acid would have this sort of impact? You know, and it wasn't even at the recommended minimum dose. You know, but to me, I was very excited about this because what a nice, simple little intervention, you know, we can talk to moms about. Okay, so let's move on from stress and we'll talk about pain. Okay, one of the things we need to always talk about when we talk about breastfeeding women is nipple pain. And this is Lisa Muir's study. I just think this is just a dandy study. But she found that, not surprisingly, nipple pain increases the risk of depression. Okay, 38% of women with pain compared to 14% of the women without pain were depressed. Okay, that's a big difference. I don't think we need any statistics to know that that's a significant difference. Okay, and that once that pain resolved, the moods returned to normal. She assessed not only depression, but she also did the profile of mood states. And so there were a number of sort of negative moods, and they returned to normal levels once that problem was addressed. And again, I think we can make sort of an affirmative defense about why skilled lactation support is important in postpartum depression prevention. Okay, so let me show you a couple of other little shocking studies. Why is this, you know, why am I talking about this? Because unfortunately, this is common. Somehow moms have got it, you know, have trickled down and sort of gotten this knowledge that nipple pain is normal. It's a normal part of the postpartum experience. This was actually published last summer. This is the Annals of Family Medicine. And it was looking specifically at women's health at 5 weeks postpartum. And what they were actually kind of focusing on was whether women were going to return to work. Okay, but this little statistic jumped out at me. Okay, this was a well-educated, middle-class sample in Minneapolis. 50% had nipple pain at 5 weeks. Okay, and the reason I even found out about this study is the editor wrote to me and asked me to write a commentary. It was one of those Biomed Central journals and asked me to write a commentary. Well, guess what I decided to comment on, you know. But somehow, you know, I don't think it's because lactation consultants aren't working hard. I don't think it's because, you know, the resources were necessarily missing, although I think, you know, unfortunately in a couple cases that may have been true. I think somehow moms have got it in their mind that this is normal and you just have to kind of, like, suffer through it. You know, and I've been really kind of pondering, how can we get that message out that it isn't? You know, and I think some of it kind of comes back to that self-efficacy, too. You know, if a mom sees somebody who tells her that that's normal, that she feel empowered enough to find another, you know, another person who can maybe help. Okay, you think, okay, well, that's just the U.S. Okay, this is Canada. Okay, 52% at 2 months postpartum had sore or cracked nipples. Okay, you know, that's just a scandal. And you know darn well there's been a lot of those women who have stopped breastfeeding, you know, along the way. Okay, so one of the things why this is interesting, and you know, in terms of that inflammation and pain connection, is that the cytokines are stimulated by something called substance P. Okay, and substance P is actually the neuropeptide that you see in pain. Okay, so particularly in a lot of chronic pain studies, that's one of the variables. It has to be measured through cerebral spinal fluid, so you don't obviously want to do that sort of willy-nilly. But substance P comes up a lot. Okay, and it's, I think, very cleverly named P for pain. Okay, but one of the things it does, it is also, the cytokines also increase prostaglandin synthesis. Okay, and I wanted to mention, this is one of the ones they specifically mentioned, COX-2. Okay, and, you know, all over the world, the COX-2 inhibitors, a new class of sort of anti-inflammatory medication, Vioxx, Celebrex, all of those are COX-2 inhibitors. Ibuprofen, which is, it's a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. Ibuprofen actually inhibits both COX-1 and COX-2. Okay, but COX-1 is the enzyme that protects the stomach. And so people said, well, gee, maybe we should just knock off the COX-2 or COX-1 inhibition and just prevent COX-2. Okay, but you can see there's that inflammation-pain connection. Okay, and remember, once you start increasing inflammation, it increases the risk of depression. Okay, so this was actually not in a postpartum sample, but this is looking at patients with either major depressive disorder or post-traumatic stress disorder. And what they found, in fact, was that these patients did have more substance P. Okay, so showing that sort of connection between depression and post-traumatic stress disorder and increased substance P. Okay, because one of the things that's unfortunate is when you have somebody who has, you know, particularly if they have a history of affective disorders, there does seem to be sort of a reordering of the pain threshold. And so that the pain threshold actually can be lower, and so that normal sensations sometimes get interpreted as pain. Okay, but I thought this was actually interesting too, is they were testing them in the lab, and what they found was that these people tended to also be very vulnerable to current stress, and that if you stressed them in the laboratory, that the substance P levels actually even went higher. Okay, so that this is stress responsive. You know, and again, I think that has a lot of relevance to our moms, and so it's one of the reasons why we need to sort of argue about, you know, how we have to help moms lower stress levels as much as we can. Okay, so on a related is sleep disturbance. Okay, so one of the ways that we know that cytokines, in fact, are related to depression is that when people have given patients cytokines as treatment, and cytokines get used a lot in, you know, like you hear about things like interferon treatment, you know, those are cytokines. Cytokines get used in cancer, in HIV sometimes, in hepatitis. They're a fairly common treatment. And we found that it induces this constellation of behavior that we call sick behavior. Okay, so it changes things like sleep, mood, energy, socialization, and appetite. And basically what it does is it creates depression. And they've been actually able to sort of show that in the laboratory in a dose-responsive way. So the more cytokines somebody got, the more depressed they were. Okay, and then when you start lowering the levels of cytokine, the mood improves. Okay, so you, like I said, you can see sort of a direct relationship between that inflammation and depression. You know, unfortunately, as I mentioned before, it's a bidirectional relationship. Once people are depressed, then your body starts cranking out more inflammation, so you get into this kind of bad cycle. But you do see that, you know, what I think this research literature demonstrated is the causal role. Okay, and you do actually see this in postpartum women. And I apologize, that is supposed to be IL-1 beta. But even compared to other postpartum mothers, the mothers who were saying that they were tired, that they were more, you know, they were kind of on the higher end of being fatigued, had more IL-1 beta. Now, the reason that we know that this is a connection is because what cytokines are supposed to do is make you rest. You know, they're supposed to make you tired because your body is trying to heal itself. Okay, so there again is another adaptive significance. But you can see when moms, particularly at their higher end of fatigue, their IL-1 beta is likely elevated. And perhaps the other ones too, if they weren't measured in this study. Okay, now this is some of Maureen Greer's work, and she's, like I said, she's done some amazing stuff too. And what she found is that fatigue was correlated with stress, depression, and infection in both the mother and the baby. So what she discovered is when they had stress and depression, that the mothers were more prone to infection. Okay, and they were more prone to infection, and also the babies were. And she thinks, you know, it has to do again with the impact of stress and depression on the immune system. Because one of the things that we see is it, what we call, you know, we talk about these effects, we talk about it being dysregulated. Okay, so we have this increase in inflammation, but we also have, you know, a concurrent decrease in lymphocytes. And so the body becomes less effective at fighting infection. Okay, but I think this was interesting. She didn't really talk about, you know, what she thought the impact of this would be, but I think it obviously has some relevance. I think it's something we need to follow up on, is that stressed and depressed moms also had lower levels of prolactin, not only in their blood, but also in their milk. And so, you know, I think that's going to probably have some kind of impact on breastfeeding. Okay, and this was actually just came out last month. Another of her studies found also, too, that, you know, again, there's that relationship between depression and fatigue, okay, and that the moms who were depressed reported more fatigue and daytime sleepiness. And one of the points that she makes, which I think is absolutely valid, is for mothers, this is one of the most distressing symptoms, just feeling like you just can't do it, you know. And so, yeah, she said, you know, it is something we absolutely need to be paying attention to. Okay, she also found that the cortisol levels were abnormally low. And this is something you sometimes see. Now, for a while, the research literature had always said, you know, in depression, cortisol levels are elevated. What we now kind of see is that they can either be too high or too low. And so we talk about it in terms of a dysregulation. Okay, there's a certain amount that you do need. But, you know, in this case, her mom's had abnormally low. And, you know, cortisol is a steroid. I mean, it's like it does tend to, you know, kind of bump up energy. So you can see if mom's had kind of low levels. The other thing that I think this study also says is that when you have low cortisol, cortisol is anti-inflammatory. Remember, I talked about those things, those three parts of the stress response being in a feedback loop with each other. And so when inflammation levels get high, cortisol is supposed to kind of come along and sort of dampen it down. And it doesn't necessarily if it's abnormally low. Now, if you have a situation where it's abnormally high, you would think, okay, well, that should lower inflammation. Well, you know, it's kind of interesting about that because I was wondering about that myself. And what Bruce McEwen said, who is one of the big researchers in this area, is he said, you know, when you have somebody who's either severely stressed or depressed, those are the two examples he gave, he said, instead of cortisol behaving like it was supposed to, he said that it actually becomes very dysfunctional. And so even though you have high levels of it, what it actually starts doing is actually potentiating or increasing inflammation. He says instead of lowering it like it's supposed to, it's like actually elevating it. And so I think that that's how you can see the high levels of both cortisol and inflammation. Okay, so the main thing is, you know, what you want to do is think about it, is moms need an optimum amount. They don't want too much, they don't want too little. Okay, in this study, she also found that the IL-6 were three times higher in the depressed moms, although she said that that did not reach statistical significance, and I think it had something to do with the normal distribution of, you know, the scores. Okay, now this is actually a very good paper. I actually have this up on the Granite Scientific site, but it was one of the first literature reviews I've ever seen that looked specifically at sleep in postpartum women. And she actually noted some abnormalities, you know, among depressed women who in the postpartum period. Okay, one of the things that she noted, and this is a pattern you tend to see in depression, is what they call reduced REM latency. So basically it means that REM sleep, that sort of highly active sleep, occurs earlier in the night. Okay, now the reason that that's not a good thing, and that's not what we want to see, is because it's that slow wave sleep that allows our body to heal itself and repair itself. If you do not have that slow wave sleep, you tend to have more pain. And where you see this very elegantly demonstrated is in the condition fibromyalgia. Because one of the characteristics of fibromyalgia is you have disturbed sleep. And you have a specific pattern of slow wave sleep being interrupted by more active alpha waves. You know, and it's like, you know, when I was writing the article for International Breastfeeding Journal, one of the reviewers said, you know, that they didn't like this example at all. They said, well, that's a very controversial diagnosis. And it's kind of like, you know, all I had to do is just talk about the physiological criteria. You know, because some people say, well, you know, just because it's due to patient report, you know, we can't really trust it. Well, there actually have been a lot of physiological markers, but they're not ones that show up in a normal sort of, you know, GP exam. You don't necessarily see them in kind of, you know, general medicine. But things like increased levels of substance P in the cerebral spinal fluid, you know, obviously you're not going to just necessarily pick that up. But in sleep studies, you see these abnormal patterns. And in fact, Moldovsky is one of the researchers who's really kind of like demonstrated this in a number of studies. He's actually been able to induce fibromyalgia in the laboratory. And he does it in a very simple way. He brings people in, you know, puts them, you know, hooks them up to all the little EEG monitors and everything, and every time they go into slow wave sleep, they wake them up. Yeah. You know, and if you do that, when the patient wakes up the next morning, besides being very annoyed with you, they, you know, they will have head-to-toe pain. Okay, so again, thinking about that sort of link between sort of the fatigue and the sleep and the depression and the pain, these all things tie together. Okay, and what she also said too, and I thought was interesting, is that particularly if women have a history of affective disorders, you know, she thinks that they women actually become more sensitive to the normal changes of pregnancy. Because again, you know, obviously the body's going through quite a lot of change during pregnancy and postpartum. Okay, now again, this is an excellent review, but she's one of the ones who recommends no nighttime breastfeeding. Yeah. I was thinking about writing her an email. What do you think? Okay, this is also, again, looking at, you know, in a general psychiatric population, but that if you have sleep disturbances, it increases inflammation. You know, and again, we kind of suspect that, you know, given the relationship with things like pain and stuff. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about psychological trauma. Now, I'm not going to actually talk about all the different kinds of trauma. I actually want to talk specifically about trauma related to birth. Because, again, I think that in some ways is a more immediate concern. But a lot of what I'm going to say applies to other types of trauma. So if you're talking about women with a history of family violence, childhood abuse, unfortunately, peer sexual assault seems to come up more and more. You know, as I said, it's just awful. You know, and it's particularly if you've got women who are also experiencing current intimate partner violence. If any of you are interested in this, I actually do have a paper that it was part of that research symposium looking at violence against women in the perinatal period. There's not that much research on it, but what there is actually pretty interesting. Okay, so one of the things that we know is that, you know, birth is physiologically stressful. I don't think that comes as a huge shock to any of you. But that, you know, cortisol levels are often elevated. And again, there is sort of an optimum amount of cortisol, you know, sort of when the system is functioning normal. We do want some of that. It has a lot of useful purposes. Okay, but that if it becomes severe or overwhelming, you can increase the risk of post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, you know, the number of people who actually meet full criteria, it's actually a fairly exacting criteria that people have to fulfill in order to get a diagnosis of PTSD. That severe or overwhelming stress can actually lead to PTSD. But people can have symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder that can actually be very distressing. Okay, so let me show you actually something I thought this was just a fascinating study. This was one of those studies I immediately put into use. At the time when I first read this, I was the area professional liaison in our area. And I had a leader up in the North Country who was working with a mom. And she was also a labor support doula. And this poor mom had, you know, the labor from hell, the postpartum from hell. I mean, it was just everything that could have gone wrong had. Well, this woman was 7 to 10 days out, and her milk still hadn't come in. And I remember sitting in Panera, I could actually place myself there, and calling my husband and saying, get me Dana's phone number, because this study, I thought, just so demonstrated exactly what was going on. And it's good for you to know, because you may encounter women in this situation. In fact, you may have already encountered this. And if you know that there's this effect, you can kind of work around it. Okay, so what they did in this study, this was from Guatemala, they measured cortisol before and after birth. Okay, so they kind of got a baseline. Okay, and what they found was that women who had the highest levels of cortisol, it delayed lactogenesis by several days. Yeah, so it was exactly what was happening with this poor woman. Okay, where I say that I think that that's useful to know is because sometimes, you know, like let's say somebody's had, you know, just this horrendous, you know, birth experience and, you know, breastfeeding is, you know, that her milk has not come in yet. You know, if you know that that's a possibility given her traumatic experience, you know, you can develop a plan with her and say, look, this is what I think is going on, you know, and you can talk to her. And unfortunately, it probably means some supplementation. But so often when women have these, you know, awful birth experiences, and then if breastfeeding crashes, you know, it's like a double loss, you know, and it just compounds it. It's just horrible. And so, you know, if we know what's going on physiologically, I think we can actually take some kind of preventative steps. You know, and yeah, I would agree with moms. I'd say, wow, you know, I really don't want to do that. But, you know, it's certainly not the optimum. But let's see if we can make sure that the rest of the breastfeeding experience goes smoothly. Okay, so One of the things I was very, very excited to see as developed in the literature is people talking about post-traumatic stress disorder as being a possibility following birth. When I actually first started talking about this when we did the first book, there was actually no study that looked at this. It was really interesting because you would read like the research studies and they would say, well, there's no evidence that birth experience has any impact on women's mental health. Now, does that ring true for you? Yeah. And then what you would see were these accounts in the literature with, you know, these horrendous experiences and women just pouring out these experiences, right? You know? And I remember thinking, you know, this is PTSD we're describing here. And so that's what we did is we actually took, you know, a model from the child maltreatment field and actually sort of tried to adapt it then for birth. You know, and so you can imagine I'm absolutely thrilled. Now, I remember actually back in those days, you know, I was a postdoc, so of course we know everything. It's like I always say, you should make all major decisions right after you graduate from graduate school because you know everything then, and it goes downhill from there. You know. But anyway, I wrote an article about birth experience and sent it to obstetrics and gynecology. They were slightly less than thrilled to receive that from me. But one of the things that they said in the review was, this was so shrill and polemic that it was likely, you know, unlikely to be useful at all. And, you know, it was funny because it's like, it was the mother's stories. Because the mothers were describing the experience, you know, as being like a rape. You know, I remember actually looking at with one of my colleagues at the lab, and I said, shrill and polemic. I said, that's bad, right? You know, it's like... And she was like, what were you thinking? I said, yeah. Now, this is Cheryl Beck, and Cheryl Beck just does absolutely amazing work. She's at the University of Connecticut. She's a nursing professor there, and we've actually been corresponding for several years, and I've actually just had a chance to meet her, so it was really cool. But she does amazing work on this. And, you know, it's funny because I do find that, you know, I've always said that nurses are much more tuned into this than a lot of other health professions. And this is actually where probably the majority of the research has come from, is the nursing research. But she did a review article, and I actually think I have this one up on my site too, looking at post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of birth. Okay, so that's kind of what she found. Now, that doesn't look like very much, right? 1.5 to 6%. I'm going to give you something to compare that to in a minute. Okay, but up to 30% had post-traumatic stress symptoms. Okay, so that's a lot. Okay, and that intrusive thoughts and nightmares were the most common symptom. Okay, so again, thinking about what we just talked about in terms of sleep, you know, having intrusive symptoms and waking up repeatedly during the night or not being able to get to sleep, you know, that has a huge impact. And that's kind of sort of the gateway, I believe, into depression. Okay, and it's something I've heard over and over and over again from moms. They say, you know, every time I close my eyes, right, they're replaying their birth. Okay, so let's talk about what those figures mean. 1.5 to 6%. Doesn't sound like much. Now, one thing I should tell you about the 1.5%. In that study, they excluded all women with a history of PTSD or depression. In other words, the women most vulnerable to PTSD and depression. So I think that was actually kind of a low amount. Well, you know, I'm in the field of trauma psychology. And, you know, sort of in the weeks and months after September 11th in the United States, you know, the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center, you know, a lot of my colleagues actually went to New York City and, you know, were surveying residents. And there have been a number of studies that have shown, you know, that the residents were having, you know, a fairly hard time, not surprisingly. You know, a lot of them had lost family members, friends. You know, some people actually lost, you know, sort of whole networks of friends. You know, we had people, there was a woman I interviewed for the new postpartum depression book. And, you know, for several hours they couldn't locate her sister. You know, and it was right, you know, sort of as she was just getting ready to have a baby. You know, and she talked about how that kind of impacted her. So, you know, September 11th was, of course, a huge, huge, huge issue. Okay, but in that, what they discovered was that when they surveyed residents of Lower Manhattan, which is where this event took place, the PTSD rate was 7.5%. Okay, that's people meeting full criteria. There were a lot of other symptoms. Okay, now, to my mind, 7.5% is not that different than 6. Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I've got a graduate student right now who's looking at this, and she, you know, was reviewing Beck's article, and she goes, well, this is a tiny little number. And I said, you know, it really isn't, and I showed her. Okay? So basically what we're talking about is a similar number between birth and a terrorist attack. Okay? That, I think, is very significant. Okay, now in talking to women about birth, this is actually one of the things I've actually found to be kind of a useful construct. Charles Figley, who's another researcher, and he comes out of the VA system, and you know, so his stuff is really, you know, combat oriented, and in fact he was the one who was the big editor for the trauma and stress series, and I did the Handbook of Women's Stress and Trauma, and I told him I wanted to have a chapter in there on perinatal trauma, and he said, "Oh, okay, really?" And I said, "Yeah, you know," and I mean, he was game. You know, it's just like it had not actually come into his sort of, you know, radar. But he edited a book back in 1985 and 1986. It was two volumes, and it was called Trauma and Its Wake. And it actually became kind of one of the seminal volumes of post-traumatic stress disorder. And it was really an attempt for probably the first time to bring together all the sort of different fields of study. And, you know, as Rosemary mentioned, I'm in the trauma psych division of American Psych Association. You know, and it really actually has been very educational for me, you know, coming from the family violence field, to meet people who do things like disaster relief or who work with, you know, survivors of natural disasters, you know, to kind of see that broader trauma perspective. And anyway, what Charles said in his kind of introduction and trying to tie all these things together. And so they had research on Holocaust survivors. They had research on women who'd been raped. They had people who'd been in combat, people who'd been tortured, you know, this really range, people who'd been in, you know, horrible natural disasters. A huge, huge, huge range of different types of experiences. And he was trying to kind of sort of weave them together. And I actually have found this to be a very useful framework to talk to moms about this. You know, in sort of trying to see what all of these very different experiences had in common, what he said was, an event will be troubling to the extent that it is sudden, dangerous, and overwhelming. Yeah. And this is something that's very, very helpful to tell to moms. You know, and one example I always use that I think fits us so good is I interviewed this woman for the first book, and she, you know, had ended up with a prolapse cord and an emergency cesarean under general anesthesia. You know, and then they sent her home, you know, and didn't expect that she would have any reaction at all. She thought she was going crazy. She really did. And that's actually something you hear a lot in trauma survivors because they don't understand the the physiological symptoms, you know, and that they're experiencing. They think they're losing their mind. But what happened in her case is, she's in laboring, and, you know, she had a fabulous relationship with her OB. And in fact, she's actually been able to really educate him quite a bit. In fact, she even got a volunteer job on the unit. And so I said, you know, she's kind of like this sort of patient stalker. You know, she makes sure he knows this stuff. But she was able to actually talk to him a lot about what her experiences have been like. Because, you know, honestly, this is not necessarily within the training of physicians. No. Yeah. I'm not going to repeat that for the mic. It was no, and then there was an expletive. But, you know, in her case, you know, she's sitting in the, you know, she's laboring, everything's going well, and her OB comes in and says, you know, listen, this would probably move along a little quicker if we ruptured your membranes. What do you think? You know? Right? Her and her husband said, yeah, okay, let's give that a try. I mean, so she was involved in this decision, and, you know, like I said, she feels positively about that part of it. Well, the cord prolapsed. And she said, in just the blink of an eye, it went from okay to medical emergency. And she said, then, you know, they have her up on all fours, you know, the nurse is holding the baby's head off the cord, and they're yelling, OB emergency, over the PA system. Okay, then she's rushed down the hall, and they gave her a C-section under general. Okay, so it had all three aspects, sudden, dangerous, and overwhelming. And actually, in my experience, actually, this one is probably the more critical. Do women feel that they or their baby are in danger? Okay, and that's actually what Cheryl Beck's research has found, too. You know, and you see this with crime survivors. You know, it's like an example I gave one time. I was speaking to a group of OBs in Wisconsin, and the guy right before me, 75 minutes about why elective C-sections were a good idea. You know, and so I'm thinking, oh, I'm dead. I've got, you know. But I said, you know, how many of you have ever had patients who you thought their birth went fine, and the woman was unhappy with it? You know, I said, I think I can tell you why this happens. You know, and it's like, you know, sometimes people will argue and they'll say, well, you know, it wasn't medically true. She was never in any danger. It doesn't matter. It does not matter from the woman's perspective, from her experience, if she thinks she was. And the way I explained it to them is I said, you know, if you have somebody who gets kidnapped and the victims are convinced that the assailant is going to kill them, even if the assailant never, ever thought about even doing that, from the victim's perspective, you know, they're going to have an impact of that. You know, and oftentimes that is the thing that actually is the worst, is, you know, sort of thinking, you know, I'm going to die, okay, or my baby's going to die. Okay, the overwhelming aspect is also kind of important, because this happens not only to women, but it also happens to partners. And oftentimes, particularly male partners, will, you know, think, I should have protected. You know, and they're really being asked to do something that, honestly, I don't think they can do. You know, they don't have any more power in that situation than a woman. You know, and there was an article in the literature, and it was talking about, do childbirth education classes, you know, sort of increase these disappointed reactions. And the example they used, I don't think, demonstrated their case at all. There was a woman who was being wheeled down the hall for a cesarean, and her husband fainted in the hall on the way down. And when he woke up, he was furious with her. Okay, and so the author was blaming the childbirth education class. Didn't quite see that. You know, but the fact is, he was overwhelmed by that hospital situation, you know, and that's the way he responded to that, because I'm sure he was probably mortified that he did that. But the overwhelming aspect affects not only women, but also their partners. Okay, so as I mentioned before, this is Jan Kegel Glaser. One of the things that she has noted, and she does it a lot, she's actually one of the people that first identified that caregiver stress response. Her lab is at Ohio State, and she's just, like I said, she's an amazing researcher. But she actually found that the history of affective disorder does seem to prime that stress response. Okay, so that when you are faced with a subsequent stressor, that you are going to have a stronger response. Okay, and so that you get more inflammation in a more rapid way to current stressors. Okay, so what does this all mean? And I think actually it does have a number of practical implications. Okay, so the first thing we want to do is we want to reduce maternal stress. You know, and again, there's a lot of times stresses we can't really address, but I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the other things that we can do. Okay, and we also want to talk to moms about reducing inflammation. Okay, so we got to reduce maternal stress. How can we do that? Breastfeeding might work. Now, this is actually a nice little study. It was published in Health Psychology. And again, this is not a perinatal journal by any stretch. The fact that they were referring to these women as breastfeeders, you know, kind of gives you a little bit of a clue. You know, I remember reading that the first time. I'm thinking, breastfeeders? What is that, like a bottom feeder? I mean, it's like, you know, it's not very elegant, you know. But what they did in this study, which I thought was actually quite ingenious, because they managed to get methodologically around one of the biggest issues, was what are the pre-existing difference between women who breastfeed and women who bottle feed. They had women who were doing both. And they actually did multiple sort of assessments over kind of a period of a day. And what they found was within these same women that when they breastfed, it decreased their negative mood. But when they bottle fed, it decreased the positive mood. And so like I said, yeah, it's a really nice study. Okay, now this one was also kind of showing the same thing. And this one was actually published in Germany and had a larger sample. But what I thought was kind of intriguing about this is they looked at a couple different things. Was it being, you know, the status of a breastfeeding woman, you know, just the fact that you were breastfeeding, yes, no? Was it holding the baby, or was it actual suckling in at the breast? They looked at all three of those. Okay, and what they found was that breastfeeding, particularly suckling at the breast, decreased, you know, those two stress hormones, ACTH and cortisol. Okay, and that in fact, it buffered moms. For about a half hour after they suckled at the breast, moms had this nice little cloud around them. So that even when they tried to stress them in the laboratory, they didn't have that response. You know, so I think again, that's very cool. And it kind of also too argues that it's that sort of continuous nature that tends to sort of buffer and protect moms. Okay, and that it was specifically suckling. Okay, and again, that's something to think about. Those of you who work with like a NICU population, whose babies aren't necessarily at the breast yet. You know, those moms actually are a little more vulnerable. I mean, the social support and everything really makes a big difference and also helps. And so, but to think about that, those moms actually might be more vulnerable because they're not getting that sort of suckling yet. Okay, so Maureen Gruer actually looked at a lot of this literature, and one of the things that she noted is that breastfeeding downregulates the stress response. Okay, and she said from sort of an evolutionary or adaptive sense, you know, what that does is it directs the mother toward milk production, it conserves her energy, and it encourages her to nurture her baby, which I think we all agree are very good things. Okay, but this actually, in my opinion, is probably the most important study that's been studied in the last 10 years. And this is looking at what is the impact of breastfeeding on the babies of depressed mothers. Okay, it's the first one that looked at this. You know, it's like I actually have two of the seminal works, you know, reviewing the literature on, you know, maternal depression and babies and children. Breastfeeding is not even in the index. Okay, I know this. I've seen these studies. They never even ask usually. Okay, this one did. Four groups of mothers. Breastfeeding women who were either depressed or not depressed, bottle feeding women, depressed or not depressed. Now, what they measured was the baby's EEG patterns. Okay, and what they were specifically looking for was something that's known as right frontal asymmetry. It's a pattern. It's an abnormal activation pattern. And basically, it's something we see in chronically depressed adults. Now, the reason they did that is it's very difficult, as you might imagine, to assess depression in babies. You know, you can't exactly use all the tools that we normally do. And so what they've been trying to do, what researchers are trying to do, is because, you know, you look at a baby who's, you know, got a depressed mom and they looked depressed. You know, but obviously that's a very subjective, you know, response or reaction. So they were looking for physiological correlates. So that's actually what they studied. Okay, so this is what they found, was that the babies of depressed breastfeeding mothers had the same pattern as the babies of the non-depressed mothers. They had a normal pattern that was not true for the depressed bottle feeding mothers. Okay, so in other words, breastfeeding protected those babies against the harmful effects of maternal depression. Yeah, I think that's an extremely important study. Actually, I'm getting kind of goosebumps. But, you know, it's interesting. I was talking at the New York WIC conference last fall, and, a mom came up to me, and she was a WIC peer counselor. She's Latina and lovely. And she said, you know, for so many of my moms, she said, they think that they shouldn't breastfeed while they're depressed because they're going to give it to the baby. And I said, you know, and I think that's actually common. I've heard that in other cultures, too. And I said, you know, I pulled up the slide, and I said, let me show you something. And she says, oh, I can tell my mom's that. You know, she was very excited about that, that it is actually protective. Okay, and the reason is because of the way that breastfeeding works. You know, again, thinking about it in terms of sort of a survival, the way that breastfeeding works is that you cannot disengage from your baby. That is a frequent pattern you see with depressed moms is they tend to disengage. They're not making eye contact as much. They're not stroking, touching. They're leaving the baby, sometimes in the car seat. Right? I mean, I've certainly seen this, you know, out, you know, not only with moms I've talked to, but also, you know, moms that, you know, I've seen out in, you know, the real world. But they couldn't do that when they were breastfeeding. And so the breastfeeding moms actually touched, stroked, and looked at their babies more often than the moms who were depressed but not breastfeeding. Okay, so, I mean, I think that's just amazing. And again, it's something that we can tell because, you know, something moms who are depressed worry about is, am I damaging my baby? Right? They're worried about that. And in fact, in some extreme cases where there's been infanticide following postpartum depression, often when they talk to the moms about why, they said, well, I really thought I'd already damaged my baby and the baby would be better off. Okay, so, you know, it's something we need to be so careful how we talk to moms about. But breastfeeding is protecting that baby. Okay, I just want to mention one other thing here. You know, when we talk about sort of what are some stress-reducing things. Now, this is the average age over 50, so obviously we're not talking about a postpartum sample. But, I'm just not even going to go there. But one of the other things we want to talk about in terms of some of the other treatments that we know for depression, and again, I have kind of a whole talk on this, but I like to toss this out because, again, it's something we can talk to moms about. Okay, this was actually a randomized clinical trial at Duke University Medical School. It was the first one that looked at exercise as a treatment for major depression. Okay, that's MDD, major depressive disorder. Okay, and it was obviously not a postpartum sample. Okay, and actually they put Zoloft head-to-head with aerobics. Right? Okay, and what they found was that the aerobics worked as well. There was no difference between the aerobics group and the Zoloft group. Okay? You know, it's funny because a lot of times people will say to me, well, you know, these alternative treatments are fine for, you know, mild to moderate depression. You know, and many of them, that probably is the primary indication. But, you know, when you start seeing these kind of effects, it's pretty exciting. You know, and again, it's another sort of alternative. It's something that we can talk to our moms about. And it doesn't take a lot. It's 2 to 3 times a week, 20 to 30 minutes. Okay? That's all you need to get this sort of antidepressive effect. Now, this is, I thought was actually even amazing. Look at this. The relapse rates. Okay? The people who were doing exercise had a much lower rate of relapse once they went off the meds. Or once the other people went off the meds. The, exercise group was 28% relapse. The Zoloft group was 51%. Yeah. And again, I think what it is you think about it in terms of that stress inflammation model. You know, you're giving people ways to cope with stress. And so if you interrupt that stress response, you're interrupting depression. Okay, so the next thing is to reduce inflammation. Okay, and this is where we get to talk about one of my very favorite subjects, which is the omega-3 fatty acids. Now, on your CD, I actually do have all the dosage information and sources. There's a number of sources of products that are safe. Many of them are quite inexpensive. I'll tell you the one I take, Nature Made, and nobody in my family makes it, sells it, has any way profitable from it. But the reason I mention that one is because it's certified as being safe for it being, you know, tested from all the different contaminants that we worry about, mercury, PCBs. It's certified by the U.S. Pharmacopeia. Okay, so again, all that information is on your CD. But that is $5 for 100 at Walmart, at least here in the U.S. Okay, so it's a very affordable option. You know, and ever since I've kind of started doing this work, I have, you know, sort of my family taking this. I have Chris at the post office taking this. I have, you know, it's like but it really actually does make a big difference, and I'm going to kind of show you why. Because, again, thinking about that sort of inflammation piece, you know, it's like I've talked about this stuff for years because we've been seeing such promising results in it, and it is something that is good for you. It doesn't have sort of the downside. But it wasn't until we sort of understood that inflammatory process that we understood really why these work and why they make a difference. Okay, again, this comes from Jan Kegel-Glaser's work, and it's really interesting because both of us have been kind of like kind of coming to the same point of view, and we've been corresponding back and forth. She actually just got a big grant from NIH to study this in older adults, specifically a randomized trial. Okay, but one of the things she notes, and several other authors have noted too, is particularly in the U.S., but in many other industrialized countries, you know, there have been some fairly substantial dietary changes, and that those really look exactly like the sort of arc of diseases. You know, that you see over that same 100 years, a big increase in depression, a big increase in heart disease, a big increase in type 2 diabetes. You know, and a lot of it has to do with what we've done to our diets. You know, and again, there's probably a lot of areas that where we can improve, but one of the things that I think in terms of mental health effects, the most compelling, are these sort of ratios of omega-6 fatty acids to omega-3s. Okay, and what she noted is that, you know, at one point, you know, sort of in a more natural diet, you know, our ratio was about, you know, 2 to 1 of omega-6s to omega-3s. You know, she said now kind of the current American diet is about 17 to 1. So, you know, we're clearly out of whack. And part of it has to do with vegetable oils. You know, we eat a lot more vegetable oils because they're in a lot of processed foods. They're very stable in terms of shelf life and stuff, so they tend to show up in a lot of foods. Okay, and then basically our diet is pro-inflammatory. Okay, but particularly this is an issue for pregnant and postpartum women. Okay, because the baby needs these fatty acids for their development. Okay, so oftentimes women are kind of already deficient coming in. You know, and again, there's exceptions. You know, places like Norway, Japan, where people eat a lot of fish and seafood, don't have these issues. But, you know, there was a very good review article published in the Australia New Zealand Journal of Psychiatry. Now, one of the things I want to mention, too, is the American Psychiatric Association in 2006, the end of last year, actually issued a statement that said that omega-3 fatty acids were good for the treatment of mood disorders. Okay, that's huge for them. That is huge for them. Okay, so like I said, there's so much stuff coming out on this. It's really exciting. But one of the things that we also know is that pregnancy does decrease stores. Okay, and this is actually from Reese's article in Australia New Zealand Journal of Psychiatry. And she said that, you know, in the last trimester of pregnancy, babies need about 67 milligrams of DHA for development. And she said the average Australian mother was getting about 15 milligrams. Okay, so big difference. You know, and that's true in other countries too. Okay, so one of the things that we do have to mention, though, is it's really only the long-chain fatty acids, omega-3 fatty acids. So it's EPA and DHA. And what the literature is kind of really showing is that particularly EPA seems to be the one that really has sort of the bang for the buck in terms of treatment. There seems to be a synergistic effect of the two of them, but for treatment, EPA is the one. DHA seems to be more preventative. Okay, and, you know, the most abundant source, of course, is the fatty cold water fish. You know, and you can see that there's, you know, there's a lot of obstacles to that. Okay, but just to kind of show you, again, you know, thinking about that sort of triangulation approach to research, you know, people look at the same issue and kind of from different angles, and you all kind of come back to the same point. There were a number of population studies published last year. And, you know, looking at just populations that eat a lot of fish and looking at their national rates of various psychiatric disorders, lower rates of major depression, bipolar disorder, childhood depression, even suicide risk. Okay, so again, I think these are kind of, you know, some very interesting findings. This is actually Joseph Hibblin's research at the National Institute of Health. He did a similar thing with postpartum women, 17,000 women in a sample, and found that women who ate a lot of seafood. And then he also had a subsample that he tested the DHA levels in their milk. And for this particular prevention thing, it was only DHA that seemed to make the difference. The other fatty acid that he tested didn't. Okay, and they had lower levels of postpartum depression. You know, and again, thinking about that sort of how can we kind of increase mothers' resilience, this is actually kind of one way because most of the mothers tend to be fairly deficient in this. I'd also kind of like to emphasize, too, that this is a little bit different than the rhetoric we hear about the DHA and formula. You know, that rhetoric is a lot of times saying, you know, building, you know, sort of bigger, better, smarter babies. You know, it's like, you know, it's kind of like it reminds me of that sort of prologue that you used to do to the $6 million man. We can make them better than they were before, bigger, stronger, faster. You know, what we are talking about in terms of this is we're talking about correcting a deficiency. So we want to actually kind of bring them up to sort of just the normal level. It's not like if you take more, you're going to be like smarter, brighter. It's more like just correcting the deficiency. You know, in the same way that we talked about folic acid, in the same way we talk about calcium. Okay, but this I've actually thought was really interesting because, again, it gets back to that sort of what is the mechanism. This was a big study that was published last summer, a population study in Italy, and they specifically looked at this, and they looked at all these ones we've been talking about, IL-1 alpha, IL-1 beta, IL-6 TNF alpha, that people who actually had higher levels of those omega-3 fatty acids had lower levels of those pro-inflammatory cytokines. Okay, and the opposite was true for people who were low in them. Okay, but this, I think, again, is another very important kind of reason. This is for us to look at this. This is Michael Myers again. And again, remember, he's the one who kind of like first started looking at this inflammation piece with postpartum. This was a group of college students. Okay, and they did a blood test, you know, kind of determined where people were in terms of omega-6, omega-3 fatty acid ratios, and found that that the students who had the adequate amounts of omega-3s, when they stressed them in the laboratory, had less of a stress response. You know, so again, there's so many things that we can't do anything about, you know, in moms' lives. I mean, you know, moms are unfortunately under a lot of stress, you know, in different situations. But can we make them a little more resilient? You know, and I actually think that this actually has some application to trauma survivors. That's actually one of the things we'll be presenting at APA, because I think that this is important. You know, for some reason, with all the affective disorders, we've never looked at post-traumatic stress disorder. But if you think about that, making people less vulnerable to stress, you know, I think that this is going to be an important area for us to look at. Okay, you know, but of course I mentioned the problem is, you know, fish and pregnancy and postpartum women is just not a good idea. Okay, now something else that's important to mention is flaxseed. You know, I actually taught for years that flaxseed was an okay alternative, particularly for vegetarians. This is the parent fatty acid, ALA, for the omega-3s. Unfortunately, it does not have any efficacy in depression. And part of it has to do with the fact that it's very inefficient metabolically. It takes something like 20 milligrams of ALA to make 1 milligram of DHA. You know, and if you're talking about a minimum of 200 milligrams of DHA, that's a lot of flax. You know, I always say, you know, clothes aren't going to be a problem because you're never leaving the bathroom. You know, it's like, okay, but there are a number of fortified foods and stuff. And again, these are all listed, and I have websites where you can take a look. The one product I don't specifically mention in any of my handouts for mothers, but I do want you to know it's an okay product, is Lipol. Because it gets packaged with, you know, those hospital bags. And I think actually that's kind of a mixed message because it is specifically marketed as, you know, people will identify sort of Lipol and DHA supplements and Lipol and formula. You know, and so I think that's for us, that's a mixed message, but I do want you to know that that is actually an okay supplement. Okay, and obviously, you know, and one place actually to really look, if you really want to like look at brands that are certified, is the U.S. Pharmacopeia website. You know, it's an independent body that's grown up to govern the nutraceutical industry. And people have to voluntarily submit to, you know, very extensive testing. And it's done periodically. It's not just done once. But it's usp.org. Okay, it's also been used, as I mentioned, EPA seems to be the one that really has the psychoactive properties. It's been used to treat both depression and bipolar disorder. What it seems to address in bipolar disorder is really more the depressive symptoms, but it does seem to stabilize it. That's what studies are kind of starting to see. Okay, but DHA by itself, you know, number of studies have found it's really not effective for treating depression. Okay, and I thought this was intriguing. This was actually with a pretty small sample, but they're actually redoing this with a larger sample. This was at University of Connecticut. Looking at specifically at moms who were high in DHA during pregnancy. So it's not an intervention study. They weren't giving it. They were just assessing their state. And what they found is that the babies actually had more mature sleep-wake patterns. Okay, now do you think that might actually be a good thing for moms? Yeah, and you know, basically they looked like they were a little bit older than they were. And again, it's not really we're trying to create sort of super babies. But, you know, oftentimes, particularly with preemies, one of the things that's a difficulty is the immaturity of that, you know, sleep cycle. And so moms are like up pretty much round the clock. And what they basically found is that there was a higher ratio of quiet sleep to more active sleep. I mean, physically active. Actually, they measured it by putting these little sensors in the crib mattress. Okay, now, you know, one other thing, you know, was as I was kind of thinking through all this, I think we're doing okay on time. One of the things that I was also kind of trying to think is, well, you know, if inflammation tends to be the sort of central piece that we're looking at, you know, how does that square with all the research that we know about the efficacy of various treatments? And the fascinating thing about this is that you keep coming back to the same place. That all these other treatments, you know, and there's a range of them, you know, we're talking exercise, we're talking social support. I don't have a slide for that yet because that's pretty new. But we're talking herbal antidepressants, we're talking standard antidepressants. All of them are anti-inflammatory. Okay, and so to me that's very exciting because I think that also, again, gives sort of another piece of, you know, line of data that actually supports that inflammation hypothesis. Okay, so, you know, one of the things we know, St. John's wort, you know, treatment with proven efficacy, it tends to be anti-inflammatory, antibacterial, antiviral. Okay, this study came out last summer in the British Journal of Psychiatry, was looking specifically at depression in cardiac patients. Now, one of the things that you know about depression in cardiac patients is that if somebody becomes depressed after they have a heart attack, they are 3 times more likely to have another one. Hey, yeah, and again, do you think that this is a group they want to know how to treat depression in? Yeah, oh yeah, big time. And so they've been kind of looking at all the different medications. Tricyclic antidepressants are not good for this population. But the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, that's the class, that's Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, that kind of whole class. They actually seem to actually be really helpful. But what was interesting about this study, it was in the British Journal of Psychiatry, is that these SSRIs actually inhibited the cytokine secretion. Okay, so it specifically worked on those things that we've been talking about. Okay, and it also lowered another inflammation marker, which is C-reactive protein. Okay, and C-reactive protein is an acute phase protein that gets released in response to increased cytokines. Okay, and probably a lot of you are aware that this is actually proven to be a pretty potent risk factor for heart disease. You know, and in fact, a lot of physicians now are ordering it in yearly physicals. We were talking about this out at a group in Los Angeles last month, and they were saying, well, what could be some blood tests that we could do? You know, CRP is actually one that can be done fairly easily because it is actually now part of the sort of standard regimen that labs do. You know, that looking at the inflammatory cytokines, I think, would be more challenging in just a normal hospital setting, but CRP is not. Okay, so what are the sort of implications of this? Okay, first of all, I think, you know, there really is ample evidence that inflammation is an important contributor to the onset and severity of depression. You know, and we've really found it to be kind of dose responsive. The higher the levels of inflammation, the more severe the symptoms. Okay, and that both physical and psychological stressors increase this. Okay, so that includes things like, you know, when you're sleep deprived, your body interprets that as a stress. When you're sleep deprived, when you've had a traumatic experience, when you've had a difficult birth, all of these things contribute. When you're having breastfeeding pain. Okay, but that, in fact, two approaches may prevent depression or reduce its severity, which, of course, is reducing stress and reducing inflammation. And again, one of the things I think we can do as healthcare providers is talk to mothers about, you know, some of these stress things. And one of probably one of the most potent things we can do is give her permission to lower stress in her life. You know, sometimes, you know, people think that women particularly think that they've got to kind of do everything. You know, and if we can kind of talk to them about, look, this is really important and this is actually going to be better for your health, it's going to be better for your baby's health. You know, is what can you do to, like, at least, you know, bring down some of this stress, get help that you need. You know, and again, we're not going to be able to undo some of these horrible situations, you know, that some mothers find themselves in. I just actually finished editing a book on intimate partner violence. And, you know, I mean, you know, some of the women, you know, their postpartum experiences are awful. But maybe what we can do is give her a little bit more coping ability. Okay, then we know that breastfeeding is also another thing. And actually, it was interesting. There's only been one study looking specifically at breastfeeding and intimate partner violence. But believe it or not, it was actually 50-50. The women who were experiencing current abusive relationships were still breastfeeding. And one of my friends, who's a intimate partner violence researcher at Johns Hopkins, you know, she said, well, you know, just in talking to a lot of moms, she's done a lot of research on this, but she said in talking to moms, the moms say, you know, the breastfeeding is something for me. You know, and she said that they would kind of work around, you know, their partner as violent behavior. You know, unfortunately, I think it actually, there's a lot of other reasons why they don't. But it is interesting, even in a situation of extreme stress like that, that women were recognizing that this was something that they were doing that was kind of helping them. Okay, but obviously, as Mima mentioned, breastfeeding problems really do increase the risk of depression. And it's important that when people start saying, well, breastfeeding is a risk factor for depression, we need to differentiate that. Are you talking about breastfeeding? You're talking about breastfeeding problems. You know, one of the reasons I really started doing a lot of work, you know, in this, particularly on the treatment options, is I was getting calls from women. You know, Lola Chilig was referring women to me, and I would talk to them about their experience with depression. And so many of them were told they needed to wean. And they would say, you know, this is the only thing that's going well. You know, and so I think it's very important that we sort of acknowledge that, but that also, you know, we acknowledge the importance of addressing breastfeeding problems. Okay, and finally, and this is the piece that we come to over and over and over again, is that all of the treatments that we know that are effective for depression, and they're very diverse, you know, even including things like psychotherapy, lower inflammation. And so with that, I would like to thank you very much for your attention, and I believe we have 15 minutes left for questions.
I think this one, is this one working? Yeah. It's really exciting to see someone in your field to...
there you are. Okay.
To start getting the inflammation connection. We've been discussing it in nutrition seminars for a long time now, and so it's nice to see you. But then you left out a little bit at the end, but you're getting one area, the omega-3s,
right,
and things that's starting. But there's so much more in nutrition.
Oh, I agree.
That we can treat with. And, you know, inflammation. We need a strong immune system to fight that inflammation. And if we could, you know, nourish the that immune system instead of masking the system,
exactly,
with the drugs. And like there's doctors, Lynn Blake Tracy, I think her name is, at drugawareness.org. She has a wonderful work in getting off the antidepressants with nutrition. And...
okay, it's awareness.org. I will definitely check that out.
Drugawareness.org. Yes.
Thank you. Actually, thank you. Excellent. I will definitely check that out.
She's been studying the antidepressants for 14, 15 years now.
Yeah.
Excellent research.
Well, and, you know, I think the thing that is interesting, you're absolutely right about the, you know, we need to be talking about strengthening the immune system. And that is actually one reason why I think so much attention right now is on the omega-3s, because they do precisely that. But, yes, I definitely recognize that there are other, and we didn't talk about them today, but there are definitely other nutritional deficits that increase inflammation. You know, for example, the you know, having low levels of the B vitamins.
That
does the same kind of thing.
The glyconutrients,
yep,
is a whole other field that's just
you're
exploding.
Absolutely right.
There's so much more, and it's so easy to do.
There absolutely is. And thank you very much for that website. I will actually check it out. Thank you.
In my own experience with a premature birth, you know, trauma or whatever, I was so busy being grateful that my babies were alive that I couldn't, you know, acknowledge and... I feel like other moms maybe go through that, but for some reason you think I would be able to come up with dialogue that would have helped myself, but I have difficulty, you know, like, well, this is going okay, and it's not as sick as this other baby.
Right.
And you're glad for them to acknowledge that, but you feel like they're kind of stuffing some of their true feelings. So do you have any advice on how
I think what happens a lot of times with moms of prematures, and this is a, you know, this is a population, of course, that, you know, I've been particularly concerned about. But I think what happens in that, just in talking to a lot of moms of preemies all over the years, is that moms a lot of times will pull it completely together while their babies are sick and while their babies are in danger. And it's not unusual at all for moms to crash after things start going better with the baby. And so this is one of the things I talk to neonatologists about. I'll say, look, tell moms that this is a possibility. I mean, you know, there's always that fine line. You don't want to sort of create a self-fulfilling prophecy. Oh, you're going to become very depressed after this. But, you know, raise the issue with the mom. Say, you know, it's possible. And if that happens, you know, come back and talk to us because we have some resources. But it isn't at all unusual to find a mom, you know, 8, 9, 10 months postpartum, all of a sudden is depressed because, you know, she's, you know, cope with the baby. But again, some of these other issues, you know, aren't dealt with until the baby's out of danger. You know, and I think that that is actually kind of a very natural response. And so one way you might want to talk to moms about that is just raise it as a possibility and open the door for her. And just say, you know, this may happen. You know, moms sometimes experience this. It could even be several years, you know, before moms look back and say, you know, that was a really frightening and horrendous experience. You know, and, you know, just the fact that you had an emergency baby like that in such, you know, sort of crisis situation, you know, and it gets compounded if you've had, you know, a difficult birth and you felt like, you know, the caregivers, I mean, so all of these things sort of factor in. If you don't feel like the caregivers listened to you and talked to you when you were there in the NICU, I mean, it's just a number of issues. But a lot of times those get sort of shelved until everything else is okay. And I've actually heard from moms who've had multiple babies. And it's not until maybe the third or fourth baby that some of these issues get dealt with. You know, so I would say for moms, again, you want to walk a line. You don't want to just say, oh, this is going to happen. But raise it as a possibility. And, you know, I'm surprised at the number of moms who actually come back, you know, 6 months, a year later and say, you know, I'm having that problem that you talked to me about. And so I think sometimes that's kind of a good thing. Just kind of raise it as an issue. So she knows that if that happens to her, she's not going crazy. But, yeah, I think thank you so much for doing work with moms of those babies, because I think, you know, they really are kind of a high-risk population, and I don't think, you know, once the baby go home that they get served very well.
Thank you.
But thank you. Nancy?
Is it on? This is very politically incorrect to be asking, but I think I can get away with it here. Knowing what we now know about the biopsychological experience of the mother, do you want to comment on these moms who are often forced to work 40, 50, 60 hours a week and try to do all this, and whether or not they can even experience a normal mood and all the rest of it that we want them to have?
Well, I think, you know, like with any mental health thing, there's just, it depends on so much. You know, it depends on if she feels like she has a choice in whether she works, if she feels that she has supportive care providers, you know, that are not making her feel separated from her baby. I think for some moms, particularly if they return to work like 5, 6 weeks postpartum, which so many of our moms do, it is an, oh, 2 weeks. Oh, my gosh, it's horrible. You know, it's this tremendous stress. I mean, we can't ignore that. And I think that that's why, you know, you start looking at women when they hit their sort of 30s and 40s and they start having a lot of physical health problems. You know, and in different cultures, depression may get expressed and presented in different ways. Like, for example, you may see a big increase in pain. You may see a big increase in fatigue. And I think it does actually have a lot to do with the fact that, you know, they're working about, you know, a gajillion hours a week. But it makes a big difference if they don't feel like that they have any kind of say in it. You know, if they do, you know, it actually can be okay for their mental health, you know, even with the tremendous stress. But, you know, again, you said these moms that get forced to go back to work, that they feel that they don't have any say in it, that they have to go back because they have insurance. So that, you know, those are real issues. And I think that they do actually impact mental health. And I think if we were to survey those moms, we would find higher than average rates of depression. I have no question about that. You just see it. I mean, you see it and you hear it when you talk to moms. And I think, unfortunately, it's absurd that we expect women at 2 weeks postpartum to just sort of, you know, pick up the bundle and go right back to work. It's just, you know, when they've experienced this major, major life change, you know. So it's not only a physiological stressor, I think it's very psychologically stressful. And, yeah, I think we would see very high rates of depression in that group. Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting what you said about depression being the highest in the last trimester of pregnancy. And I've experienced a lot of, from myself and my friends, sleep deprivation in the last trimester.
Yep.
Is that because of the cytokines? And would you actually recommend sleep pills, you know, in the last trimester to get more sleep because it affects the birth and, you know, the depression and having energy for the birth and, you know, everything?
I would say it really depends a lot on the mom, you know, and how sleep deprived she is. Because, you know, of course, it always comes down to sort of one of those risk-benefit analysis. You know, so we have to kind of weigh, you know, what are the risks of taking a sleeping medication? You know, I would probably look into some of the more natural stuff, but not sleeping very much in the last trimester also predicts depression. So, you know, again, depending on the mom I was working with, you know, that is certainly one option. You know, obviously postpartum, if she's taking sleep medication, we don't want her sleeping next to the baby just because that would be dangerous. But in terms of like making sure she's getting some good quality sleep, probably what I would do first is a first-line defense. If I had somebody who was very seriously sleep-deprived, is I would do some of the psychological things that intervene with sleep medicine. So I'd you know, talk about things like, you know, the sleep hygiene, you know, making sure there's a bedtime routine and that she's getting relaxed before. I mean, there's a lot of sort of non-pharmacological things you can do to improve sleep quality. But if a mama's really, really struggling, yeah, I would certainly consider that an option.
But is that sleep deprivation and waking up frequently, is it due to the cytokines?
That's a very good question. We know it's related to the depression, but whether that has a mechanism yet, we don't know yet. Just because, like I said, this research is new enough, we haven't necessarily sort of filled in all the pieces, but I wouldn't be surprised. You know, like I said, given, and, you know, there seems to be also a susceptibility to depression that you see. And so, you know, it's like if women have had previous histories of depression and stuff, I think they are going to probably have more of this sort of cytokine relationship. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if we see that, but we haven't found it yet.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Hi. Is that on? Okay. I know that you said that depression can lead to premature birth.
Right. It's a risk factor for it.
Right.
Yeah.
I was kind of wondering about a reverse situation. Personally, I have a relative who is pregnant. She has a history of depression.
Okay.
She's on Zoloft now, has been on Paxil.
Okay.
And Prozac both in the past. And she has some physical high-risk abnormalities that mm-hmm. put her at a higher risk for either C-section or premature birth or both. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, with all that, plus her previous history of depression, what in any other patient that has similar problems like that that any of us may encounter, what would you recommend for that kind of situation?
Well, I think probably in her case, I think, first of all, just recognizing that that's a pretty high-risk situation for depression. I mean, she's kind of got numerous risk factors
right.
for it. And, you know, so I think that recognition, I think probably talking to her about some of the non-pharmacological things, because she's already doing the medication. So thinking about, you know, like how can she increase her social support now and postpartum, you know, and having that kind of in place. You know, even the fact that she maybe comes in at 2 weeks postpartum, you know, and check in with her healthcare provider, you know, just having, you know, all the kind of support and stuff in place that she can. I would probably start, you know, a program of sort of a moderate exercise.
Right.
You know, I would think honestly about the omega-3s. And like I said, I'm not selling these, but it's like I think it's something that would be kind of helpful in terms of a preventative aspect. I wouldn't just do that, though. You know, I said I'd look at exercise. I'd look at some social support. I'd look at psychotherapy. You know, these would be sort of like a multi-prong approach because I think the more supports we have in place for her and the more ways we kind of address this, I think the better off she's going to be. But I think the fact that you guys are aware of this, I think is going to actually do a lot to heading this off because, you know, I think sometimes it's the moms who don't have any idea that they're, you know, they're on the train and the train is coming and they don't know. And, you know, this mom fortunately has you in her life who is watching and supporting her, you know, and I think that that's going to make a big difference.
Do you think breastfeeding will assist with that as well?
I believe that it will, but again, you know, it's very important, especially with her, to address any breastfeeding problems, you know, ASAP.
Right, because she's already of a personality kind of stubborn and doesn't like certain advice, and so that's the touchy part where you don't want to be like,
well, exactly, and it's always, I think it's always tricky with relatives, you know, and so it's like, again, you know, you can kind of, you know, the classic sort of league thing, we sort of offer it and they can kind of take what they want, but I think the fact that you're being vigilant about this, I think it's going to make a tremendous difference for her. Now, Rosemary's up here, which means we need to wrap up. but I'm happy to stay around and answer questions because I see several people standing there. So we'll wrap up officially on the microphone, but I'll stand here and we'll talk. Okay, thank you very much. Have a lovely lunch.
Thank you, Kathy, very much for a very interesting and informative presentation. And if you'd just like to show your appreciation again. Thank you, Kathy.